Custom House and Harper Audio present Separated, Inside an American Tragedy by Jacob Soboroff. This is the author. For Nicole, Noah, and Lucia. Family Separation and Reunification. Timeline of Key Events. March 2017. DHS Secretary states publicly that DHS might separate families who enter the United States without authorization. Weeks later, he announces DHS will not pursue the policy. April 2017. Attorney General issues memorandum prioritizing prosecution of immigration offenses. July 2017. El Paso sector of CBP implements policies resulting in increased family separations. February 2018. Miss L versus ICE lawsuit is filed. April 2018. Attorney General issues memorandum instituting zero tolerance policy at DOJ. May 2018. DHS adopts zero tolerance. The Attorney General publicly announces the policy's implementation at DOJ and DHS. June 2018. President Trump issues executive order directing DHS to detain migrant families together. June 2018. Court orders federal government to cease most family separations and reunite eligible families. July 2018. HHS identifies 2,654 separated children under Miss L versus ICE. December 2018. After multiple revisions, HHS reports a new total of 2,737 separated children under Miss L versus ICE. March 2019. Court expands the Miss L class to include parents who entered the United States on or after July 1, 2017, with children from whom they were separated. October 2019. HHS identifies an additional 1,556 separated children under the expanded Miss L class. Author's note. Facts on the ground. I am an unlikely eyewitness to one of the most shameful chapters in modern American history. The Trump administration's deliberate and systematic separation of thousands of migrant children from their parents was, according to humanitarian groups and child welfare experts, an unparalleled abuse of the human rights of children. The American Academy of Pediatrics says the practice will leave thousands of kids traumatized for life. I was there to see it myself, though I didn't expect to be, and as a journalist, almost missed the story entirely. What I saw now is forever seared into my memory. Though the Trump administration had been carrying out widespread family separations at the border for more than a year, the horror separated families endured set in for me personally on the 13th day of June 2018. I could feel the thickness of the air as soon as I walked off our United Airlines flight at the tiny Brownsville South Padre Island International Airport in South Texas. The early summer steam of the Rio Grande Valley sneaking in between the weak seal connecting the jet bridge and the plane. The gray marine layer that draped my hometown of Los Angeles when I took off no longer seemed worth complaining about as sweat started dripping down my back. As producer Arnie Hakala and I headed up the ramp, I pulled off the sweatshirt I flew in, my t-shirt now sticking to my skin even as we made our way through the air-conditioned terminal toting our carry-ons. I'm probably going to get sick, I thought to myself. We headed past the baggage claim, out the doors, under a row of palm trees, and across a small parking lot to pick up our rented minivan. We had rushed to Brownsville, not far from where the Rio Grande meets the Gulf of Mexico, after being invited by a Trump administration official to tour what is known as Casa Padre with several other journalists. Its name reflected the street it was on, meant to honor the Spanish priest who, in 1804, established the first permanent settlement on the southern tip of a nearby island. Literally translated, it means Father's House. We'd soon learn how regrettably misnamed the facility was. The 250,000-square-foot former Walmart, what we were told was a shelter, was holding nearly 1,500 migrant boys, 10 to 17 years old, hundreds of whom had been separated from their parents as a direct result of Donald Trump's zero-tolerance immigration policy. By then, the existence and execution of Trump's family separations had been widely reported, but no journalist had seen the realities from the inside. I was anxious. On the 4-mile drive from the airport, I asked Arnie to pull over at a Walgreens so I could run inside to buy a car charger for my laptop. I figured it was going to be a long night and we'd be waiting in the car in between live shots. I paced the aisles looking for one. No luck, but I grabbed a little blue notebook. No cameras would be allowed inside. Some dry shampoo. I'm a TV reporter with curly hair about to do a live shot in 90-degree humidity. And a cold Gatorade. For mysterious reasons, the yellow flavor calms my nerves. Arnie picked up a bag of almonds like he always does when we're on assignment. We paid and we're on our way. In minutes, I'd bear witness to the reality that our country, under the direction of President Donald Trump, was ripping parents and children apart. Casa Padre would become the scene of international breaking news later that night. It has now been 2 years since I walked into Casa Padre with that Walgreens notebook. After its pages were filled with four different stories, it lived on my desk at home for months, a reminder of the tragedy it had helped me document. In late 2018, as my wife, son, and I were moving out of our rental and into our first home, I put the memo book, as it says on the front in big bold type, in a bag with other valuable possessions and brought it to a storage locker. A year later, as I began writing this book, I went and dug the bag out from under boxes of Christmas decorations. With my iPhone flashlight, I found the notebook at the bottom of the bag. Holding it in my hand for the first time in months made my heart race. The reporting inside, by President Trump's own admission, contributed to his ending systematic family separations. I didn't like the sight or the feeling of families being separated, the president said, while signing the executive order that stopped the policy he had claimed days earlier did not exist. The notebook burned in my hand. Inside the 5-by-10-foot storage unit, surrounded by camping equipment and a baby-changing table and a pendant lamp that was gathering dust, I sat on a stool and flipped open its tiny cover to the first page of spiral-bound lined paper. If someone else found these 50 pages of chicken scratch, they'd have no idea what they were looking at. I barely needed to read a word to bring back the sights and sounds and feelings of being there. As of Friday, June 8th, 11,214 migrants in UAC, Unaccompanied Alien Children Program. Average length, 56 days. Translation. The U.S. government was overwhelmed by an influx of kids, many of whom couldn't be released because their parents could not be found. I kept going, stopping again on the 6th page. Kids everywhere. Oreos. Applesauce. Smile at them. They, quote, feel like animals in a cage being looked at. I recognized those details as among the first I revealed when I walked outside Casa Padre to a TV camera and told my MSNBC colleague, anchor Chris Hayes, and the world what I saw inside. This place is called a shelter, but effectively these kids are incarcerated. A monitor was set up to the side of the camera and I could see the breaking news banner at the bottom of the screen. It read, NBC News tours immigrant child detention center. The notebook now in my hands was then tucked in my pocket during the first live national report about the conditions of separated children in government custody. I brought it with me days later when, on Father's Day, I toured the Ursula Border Patrol Central Processing Station, not far away in McAllen, Texas, where more children were separated from their parents than anywhere else on the border. There, they shut families into what a Border Patrol agent told me were pods, a generous description. My notes hastily captured what I learned. Child could get moved even if parent back in a day. The Trump administration was potentially creating thousands of immigrant orphans, as a former acting director of Immigration and Customs Enforcement put it, by deporting separated parents before they were given a chance to reunite. When I closed my notebook that day in South Texas, I walked outside again and detailed on national TV what I saw. People in here are locked up in cages, essentially what look like animal kennels. I don't know any other way to describe it. I still don't. I can't recall why, but I left a few pages in the middle of the notebook blank, until I took notes during my first phone call with Lindsay Tislowski, the lawyer who represented a separated three-year-old who, she said, started climbing up on the table in court. On that call, she clued me in to the Trump administration's lack of a plan to reunite families. Everyone has been told nothing about next steps. Tislowski later introduced me to one of the parents she was describing at the time, Juan, who alleged he was coerced into signing away the right to reunify with his son, Jose. Their story appears throughout this book. I've spent hours with them recounting details of their almost five-month-long separation, a living nightmare in which, in his words, the United States government, quote, treated us like animals, like dogs. At their request, I've changed their names to ones they picked in order to protect themselves and their family from the danger they told me and the United States government they were fleeing. The image on the cover was taken near the location where they crossed into the United States before being separated, nearly a decade before they arrived together. The final pages of my notebook became home to what I saw and learned inside the San Diego courtroom, where a federal judge ordered the Trump administration to reunite separated families. That case, brought by the American Civil Liberties Union, ACLU, is still ongoing today. At the time, Sarah Fabian, the government lawyer who later became famous for arguing that migrant kids don't need blankets or toothbrushes, called into the hearing and was asked to provide a number of separated family members facing deportation. Fabian! Exclamation point. Latest numbers. Executable 1,000! Exclamation point. Two exclamation points. At the time, it all felt noteworthy. I did not plan or expect to be there at the heart of it all, when the nation finally noticed the American government was systematically separating migrant families in unprecedented numbers. Since the summer of 2017, the Trump administration has taken at least 5,556 kids from their parents. But still today, nobody knows for sure exactly how many families have been separated. In February 2020, the United States Government Accountability Office noted, quote, "It is unclear the extent to which Border Patrol has accurate records of separated families in its data system. Scarce few of their stories have been told. Most will never be. There are families who were quickly put back together, and children who were, as predicted, permanently orphaned. My one little blue notebook could never do all of their stories justice, nor is this book an attempt to. I encourage you to seek out, read, and learn about what happened from as many sources as you can." That first report from outside Casa Padre went viral. My tweets from outside the shelter before and after my tour, amassing tens of millions of impressions and tens of thousands of retweets, even before I went to sleep that evening. Tens of thousands of new people started following me on Twitter that night. Maybe you were one of them. Many of those new followers tweet me with links and leads and questions to this day. As I continued covering family separations and the fallout, I obsessively tracked the number of children the Trump administration was reuniting and those it deemed, quote, ineligible for reunification by routinely checking PACER, the online documents portal of the federal court system, for any status updates posted by the government or the ACLU. Every time I posted the latest court-ordered update about the number of separated children still in U.S. custody, I received a social media signal boost from people around the world who invested time and energy in following the details of what was happening. Without them, this story would not have received the attention it did long after most national reporters left the border. Nor would this book be possible. After having missed the slow-motion lead-up to this disaster, I became fixated on the policy and how it shattered so many lives. To those who have spent far longer than I have chronicling or experiencing life along the border, the answer was obvious. Family separations were an extreme extension of decades of harsh policies aimed at keeping Mexican and Central American migrants from entering the United States, at a time when racists and xenophobes said they felt emboldened by the commander-in-chief. But why was its implementation, according to healthcare professionals, so needlessly cruel? Why was its ending so astonishingly sloppy? And why were its ramifications so ill-considered? Finding the answers to those questions is why I decided to write this book. What follows is my attempt to fill in the blanks that I did not understand in real time. I started by revisiting my notes, as well as my public reporting, seeking to retrace my steps over 2 years. I pored through hundreds of pages of documents obtained by myself and others, including NGOs doggedly filing public records requests. Still more files have been made publicly available through investigations by inspectors general and Congress. To contextualize these documents, I spoke with dozens of sources, from those responsible for considering, implementing, then unwinding the policy, to others who were caught in its crosshairs. I heard from people who participated in and experienced the policy on the border, and some of those who directed it from Washington, including, at times, from inside the White House itself. What I have now unequivocally learned is that the Trump administration's family separation policy was an avoidable catastrophe made worse by people who could have made it better at multiple inflection points, which I'll share with you here in a series of pivotal moments presented as scenes. The dialogue you'll hear in this audiobook is reconstructed when I was present to the best of my memory or using recordings made as part of my reporting. Where I was not a firsthand witness or participant, I rely on the retelling of moments by sources who were, cross-referencing their version of events with others who were present or had knowledge of what transpired when possible. Some of those sources considered my reporting adversarial at the time the policy was carried out, but agreed to speak with me to share important details with the goal of providing an accurate historical record of events. Indeed, certain individuals may have an alternate motivation, to ascribe blame to someone other than themselves, which is why I cast such a broad net in reporting the details in this book. My mentor and producer, Mitch Koss, has always pushed me to report the facts on the ground before anything else, and they form the basis of this story. Where I was, what I experienced, who I met, and how I came to believe that separated defines not just the Trump administration's act of seizing children and breaking apart families. For Juan, Jose, and thousands more just like them, the word describes a deep understanding of physical and mental pain, an unspeakable horror they were made to endure. For many others, including for a time myself, it describes the opposite, an inability to comprehend how Donald Trump's self-inflicted American tragedy was able to happen. The existence of both of those realities is only reconciled by facing the truth about our country and ourselves. Prologue. They were going to kill us. Mugging for the camera, the 12-year-old with his hair slicked back, sporting cool sunglasses, and wearing an oversized t-shirt, reminded me of myself as a preteen, eager to hang around my dad when he was busy working. The boy, Jose, was standing in front of a wall filled with products in the small convenience store his family owned and operated in Petén, Guatemala. It was there that his dad, Juan, snapped a photo of his son, which he showed to me proudly 3 years later. When Jose wasn't there or at school, you could likely find him kicking a soccer ball around the large field with patchy grass below his family's single-story home. They were both born in Petén, a region slightly bigger than Maryland, bordering Belize to the east and Mexico to the north. Making up one-third of the landmass of the country, Petén is the largest of Guatemala's 22 departments, though only 3% of the nation's population lives there. When the photo was taken, Jose was the eldest of three children. His baby sisters were 7 and 1, and their mom, Maria, watched over them closely as the de facto head of their household while Juan, his dad, worked. Juan was one of 5 children, and Jose's grandmother and aunts and uncle were never far away, they explained. Across the field and up a pathway made of stone was their home. At the top of the ramp were the 5 archways framing the outside of their house. To the left, a covered parking space where Juan kept the family's pickup truck, and to the right, a detached kitchen where meals were made and family celebrations centered. Their life and lifestyle was, he would tell you, well off compared to many of their neighbors because Juan worked hard to make it so. It was no surprise Jose wanted to hang around his dad's shop. He had only spent half his life together with his father. Juan was 35, but had first left for the United States himself when he was 23, 2 years after his boy was born. He went to provide income for his family, returning in 2008. In 2010, he left again, this time staying away for longer, coming home in 2014. They lived a short drive from Aeropuerto Internacional Mundo Maya, an airport that services tourists coming from around the world to explore the region's spectacular Maya ruins, the remains of the Americas' extraordinary ancient civilization that rivaled classical Greece and Rome in sophistication. Juan's journeys to the United States never started or ended there. Rather, Juan would pay a smuggler or coyote to help him navigate the journey north through Mexico and into the United States illegally, sneaking across the border both times in Arizona. "They didn't catch me," he told me in English over a ribeye steak in October 2019, Jose sitting close by his side. He shrugged his shoulders and cracked half a smile. "When my great-great-grandparents arrived in the United States from Poland and Russia, I imagine they expressed a similar sense of guarded relief, one embedded in the disparate American story, a quilted patchwork of displacement and migration, journeys on ships, forced and voluntary, treks on land to seek opportunity and survival, and eventually by planes carrying refugees, students, and entrepreneurs alike. Over generations, it produced a singular American identity shaped in equal parts by pain and hope. A place that represented, for many, a new and better life, while often betraying the trust of those who dared to believe in it. Juan and Jose are now a part of that story. If Juan had flown to or from the United States on his earliest journey, he would have looked out the window to see breathtaking views of the lush terrain around his home stretching to the horizon. But by the time Juan snapped the photo of Jose in his store, his son quickly approaching his 5-foot-2-inch frame, that landscape was transforming. "Aeropuertos clandestinos," he whispered, as if anyone hearing him inside a D.C. area steakhouse chain would notice or care. Juan typed a phrase into YouTube, "Narcos aterrizando en Petén," and slid me his smartphone across the table. The search results revealed what he would have seen from the sky. Far more airports and runways down below than any official map or navigational chart would show, a symptom of the region's critical location for transnational criminal organizations, cartels, moving drugs through the country, into Mexico, and into the bodies of American consumers. Because of this, Petén had become home to some of Guatemala's highest homicide rates. Juan was living in fear of the narco traffickers who terrorized his community. In the spring of 2018, he had sold his car, which in turn was sold to someone else. One day in late April, his brother called him and said the drug traffickers had gotten a hold of the car and wanted him to sign paperwork claiming he had given ownership to them. If not, the message was relayed, they would kill Jose. Juan was able to ask the narcos for a delay, but every day that month, he was, quote, "afraid they were going to kill us." As he told me the story, Juan started to wring his hands together at the table, looking downward. He crunched the white starched napkin with his fingers, pausing to take a deep breath. He looked at me, holding back tears and shaking his head, thinking not only about the fear he experienced at home, but also the consequences his decision to flee Guatemala set in motion for him and his son. He didn't say another word. That night, after I called an Uber and dropped him and Jose off at their apartment, Juan cried as he thought about what happened to him and Jose. He texted me to let me know. On May 15, 2018, unaware that the Trump administration was systematically ripping parents away from children to punish illegal border crossers and to escape the brutal end so many others in Petén had suffered, Juan and Jose said goodbye to their family and to Maria, now pregnant with Jose's third sister and Juan's fourth child, and left their pueblo for the United States, heading north like the drugs funding the narcos in their homeland. After a risky 2-week, 2,000-mile journey, Juan made it to the Arizona border for the third time, his son's first. When they saw the border, relief passed through them. They believed they'd survived, together, one of the most dangerous passageways on Earth. They had worried daily about the hazards they'd faced as they passed through cartel-held territory: extortion, kidnapping, and murder. But they'd made it. Though apprehensive about what life held in store over the dividing line, Jose knew he had his father. Within a matter of days, on the side of the U.S.-Mexico border they believed represented safety and security, they would be forced apart from one another, unable to even say goodbye. Part 1. Ana fled her abusive partner in Mexico with 3 U.S. citizen children and 2 non-U.S. citizen children, 3-year-old Odalis and 2-year-old Rosie. After arriving at a U.S. port of entry in 2016, Anna and her children were detained and processed by Customs and Border Protection, CBP officials. Anna unsuccessfully attempted to flee the processing office to return to Mexico with Odalis and Rosie. The ICE report stated that the three U.S. citizen children were taken from their mother by officials because they were at risk of child endangerment. The report based this assessment on the assertion that when Anna was fleeing from the agents, she picked up Rosie and grabbed Odalis by the arm. CBP claims that Anna dragged Odalis a little and her face was scraped in the process. Odalis and Rosie were also taken from Anna as a result and were placed in Office of Refugee Resettlement, ORR, custody. There were no potential sponsors identified for Rosie and Odalis. The placement of their older siblings who have U.S. citizenship was never communicated to ORR, nor was information provided to ORR about how to contact Anna. After Lutheran Immigration and Refugee Service, LIRS, providers contacted Anna, they came to the conclusion that it was not in the best interests of the children to be separated from their mother, and LIRS advocated for Anna's release from ICE custody so Odalis and Rosie could be reunified with their mother. Lutheran Immigration and Refugee Service. Chapter 1. I Just Couldn't Do That. April 8, 2016. The special interests in D.C. who have controlled our political process for 40 years, they don't care about you, a balding young man screamed from the podium in a Colorado Springs, Colorado ballroom. He had yet to master the fine art of modulating the volume of one's own voice. They don't care about your family, and they don't care about your security. My eyes grew wide as I shot a look at Arnie, my producer. Who the fuck is this dude? I cannot believe this is the guy that Trump sent here to win over delegates, I said. At stake was the mantle of leader of the free world. This gathering felt like a bizarro 4th of July parade had been crammed into a single, too small room. Tensions were rising. Earlier in the day, after noticing the MSNBC logo on the microphone I was holding during live reports, an extremely large man threatened to fight me and later invited me to give him oral sex. Welcome to the Colorado Republican Party district conventions taking place in the city that is the rapidly beating heart of American evangelical Christianity. That's Stephen Miller, a local said to me, identifying the guy behind the podium, his 5 o'clock shadow seemingly filling in by the second. I was here to cover this unusual display of democracy because the Republican Party was in the middle of a hotly contested primary election, in which 1,237 delegates would be needed to clinch the party's nomination and the chance to take on either Hillary Clinton or Bernie Sanders. Colorado, like several other states, was home to a cache of unbound delegates who would cast their vote for whichever candidate they wanted come July at the National Party's convention in Cleveland, potentially helping Donald Trump put a lock on the nomination or causing him to come up short. The purpose of this madhouse event was to elect those delegates. The outcome would be determined without a primary election or caucus or any actual will of the electorate. Without a single voter backing them, the 30-plus delegates who would emerge from here after this weekend would end up being among the most influential political figures in the United States. Here in the twilight zone of American politics, Stephen Miller went on to tell the story of Kate Steinle, killed in San Francisco by a, quote, five-time deported illegal immigrant. He cited Donald Trump's recent endorsement by the thousands of Border Patrol agents, which was actually the 11-member executive committee of the Border Patrol Union, as evidence that his candidate would stop tragedies like Steinle's death. What a psycho, I felt comfortable saying aloud. He thinks he's going to win over anyone here? Several hours later, after hourly live reports on MSNBC in which I attempted to count every delegate, naming names even the most obsessed cable news viewers had never heard before, like Kendall Unruh or Joel Crank, I got word the Rachel Maddow Show requested to have me on her broadcast in prime time. A first for me since I started at MSNBC less than a year earlier. Not long before 7 in the evening local time, I put in my custom earpiece and in the other ear jammed tissue paper to block out the chatting and clinking silverware behind me. My pulse racing, I could hear our network star start her show. "Happy Friday," she started. "There's lots going on tonight." Rachel began her legendary A-block, as she always does, taking her time while discussing Bernie Sanders' campaign and its strength at competing in caucuses, a skill that had kept his candidacy alive against Hillary Clinton's juggernaut. Next, she pivoted to the Republican race, unsettled by novice Trump's surprisingly strong showing against establishment favorite Jeb Bush in the early presidential contests. She dissected the battle to win the required number of delegates in the Republican primary, pointing out that no candidate had a lock on the process. Underscoring how up in the air the moment was, Rachel brought up the rumors that House Speaker Paul Ryan might jump into the Republican presidential primary. After a commercial break, she was back in my ear and the control room was telling me to get ready. My heart pounded. "Turns out the Donald Trump for President campaign is terrible at this," Maddow said of the campaign's political strategy. "Colorado has been a case study at just how terrible they are at it. And tonight, just within the last hour, we have learned that Donald Trump, who before today had already lost 18 of 18 possible Colorado delegates to Ted Cruz, just in this past hour, we have learned that Donald Trump has just lost 3 more. Which means that in all of Colorado's congressional districts, the Trump campaign has gone 0 for 21. Ted Cruz has won all of the delegates on offer in Colorado thus far, which means Ted Cruz has won another state. NBC News is calling Colorado tonight for Ted Cruz." The red breaking news banner appeared at the bottom of the screen, and the text stretching across it switched to "NBC News, Cruz wins Colorado." With that, she introduced me, the self-proclaimed delegate hunter of MSNBC, running from state to state to see what Republican would clinch the nomination, if any, before the July convention in Cleveland. "Jacob," she asked, "what happened here? It sounded like the Trump campaign set itself on fire and couldn't find a pool of water to put it out." "I guess the official sports terminology would be an O for Rachel, O for everything for Donald Trump here," I said in a whisper worthy of a golf broadcaster, as attendees munched on a hotel dinner behind me. On the one hand, Maddow and I were both right. Cruz delegates succeeded in skunking Trump in Colorado, and as I told her that night, the Trump campaign seemed to have egg on its face. And more important, the nomination and the 1,237 delegates needed to clinch seemed at risk. Of course, we were both dead wrong about Trump's campaign prospects. Another truth emerged on that ballroom floor in Colorado Springs. Trump, while a savant on messaging, was unable to muster any organizational discipline. If Trump and Miller couldn't secure their own party's delegates despite strong support from voters, how would they fare in the dirty work of implementing policies like the one Stephen Miller was shouting about if they were to take the White House? July 18th, 2016. "You're blocking the aisle. Get out of the way." That's not what you want screamed at you by a delegate to the Republican National Convention when you're reporting live on nationwide television. "Thanks," I said while turning away from the camera to look directly at the heckler, a goateed middle-aged man dressed head to toe in Republican red, another stick microphone grasped firmly in my hand. Pivoting back to the lens, an embarrassed smirk creeping across my face, I tossed back to Steve Kornacki, who was anchoring his 4 o'clock afternoon hour on MSNBC from New York. "That's what you go through here, Steve, on the convention floor." Life wasn't at all glamorous on the campaign trail and in the middle of the madness at Quicken Loans Arena. Getting chewed out as millions watched was low on the drama scale compared to what would transpire between pro- and anti-Trump factions at the convention. "You're clear, thanks, Jacob," the producer told me in my ear. I pulled out my IFB, those coiled earpieces you see newscasters wear, and couldn't help but shake my head and laugh. I was surrounded by cowboy hats, a bespectacled and curly-haired sore thumb among the Texas delegation. A group, no doubt, that had a keen interest in what presumptive nominee Donald Trump would have to say in the days ahead about his signature campaign promise, a border wall with Mexico. Texas is home to two-thirds of the border with our neighbor to the south, more than 1,200 of the 1,900 miles stretching between the Pacific Ocean and the Gulf of Mexico. Sure enough, Trump delivered. "We are going to build a great border wall to stop illegal immigration," he bellowed a few days later toward the end of his acceptance speech as I watched from the convention floor. "To stop the gangs and the violence, and to stop the drugs from pouring into our communities." Trump turned to the policy that roiled the blood of people like Stephen Miller. "By ending catch and release on the border, we will stop the cycle of human smuggling and violence. Illegal border crossings will go down. Peace will be restored." I rolled my eyes dismissively, oblivious to how deadly serious those words and the motivation underlying them would be to the lives of tens of thousands in the years to come. Trump finished his speech, and an avalanche of red, white, and blue balloons fell from the ceiling. The control room in New York cut to a shot of me as I playfully punched them away, looking more like a kid on a playground than a journalist contemplating the GOP nominee's just stated intent to radically reshape the American immigration system. Don't get me wrong. I was keenly tracking Trump's border policy, but only because his perception of what happened at the U.S.-Mexico boundary was so different from the realities I had experienced on the ground. At the time, I would occasionally file an immigration-related piece, usually through a human interest lens. In late May, ahead of the conventions, I had traveled to a section of the border near San Diego where there was no fencing or wall. Standing there with Border Patrol agent Wendy Lee, I wondered why they wouldn't want Trump's proposed wall here, at a place where the dividing line between Tijuana and California wasn't even a line in the sand we were standing on. "We manage with what we have," she told me. In Las Vegas, I rode bikes with a young undocumented immigrant dreamer who, brought to the United States by her parents as a young child, was now canvassing for Hillary Clinton. Another dreamer I met was campaigning on the campus of the University of Nevada, Las Vegas for Bernie Sanders. Both were engaged in politics despite neither being able to vote. In Phoenix, I went inside Sheriff Joe Arpaio's tent city and met inmates living outside in scorching heat because I wanted to understand the man who said he was the original Trump. "It's crazy," one man locked up for driving under the influence said to me about Trump's rhetoric while lying on his stomach from the top bunk. Clutching a pink pillow provided by the Maricopa County Sheriff's Department, he admitted he was undocumented and was worried about getting deported as a result of his crime. Quote, "Everybody makes mistakes." After Trump's shocking victory in the November general election, mass deportations were a distinct possibility. He had, after all, talked of a, quote, deportation force that would round up and remove all 11 million undocumented immigrants living in the United States. We wouldn't need to wait to find out what mass deportations looked like. President Obama had already deported more people than any other president. As it happened, I had met some of those who were swept up in Obama's mass deportations. I first crossed the border as a journalist in the spring of 2014 while working for a little-known cable channel called Pivot, backed by the same people who made Al Gore's Oscar-winning documentary about climate change. driving a hand-me-down Volvo. I navigated the border crossing between San Diego and Tijuana and negotiated my way through roundabouts and street vendors. "This is the definition of a clusterfuck," I said to the late Jim Downs, my executive producer, who was filming me with a handheld camcorder. I said that partially because I had blown by the sign indicating we were at the last exit before heading into Mexico, where we were supposed to meet our colleagues, and now found ourselves clueless about where to go in a country we weren't supposed to be in. Jim was a wild man, a kid in a grown-up's body who was obsessed with video games and cats and adventure. 2 years later, he would die the way he lived, pursuing a good story, literally, after falling off a cliff while riding an ATV chasing bears in Alaska for a television program. Downs was adamant we show the truth about what was happening on the ground, buying a pitch from veteran producer Mitch Koss, who was hired by Downs on my suggestion. Mitch, who had spent his career traveling around the world with young correspondents at Channel One and Current TV, was waiting for us on the U.S. side of the border I had just driven past. Once we ultimately crossed together, I learned a lesson that would prove relevant in the Trump era. Mass deportations weren't a threat under Obama. They were a reality easily visible by driving minutes past the international boundary to the Casa del Migrante shelter, which housed not only migrants heading north from Mexico and Central America, but countless Mexicans who had spent nearly their entire lives in the United States before being deported by the Obama administration. In 2016, before Trump was inaugurated, Mitch and I headed back down to Tijuana, this time as MSNBC employees, having been hired together in 2015, now accompanied by an actual NBC News team, not our ragtag pivot group. Back in the same spot, it was easy to find deportees who grew up in the same Southern California county I did, but were now stuck living in Mexico for a variety of reasons, including nonviolent crimes. Most of the people I met sounded exactly like I did, too, so much so that Obama's deportations had provided a stimulus to one industry in particular in Mexico: call centers staffed with deportees for American companies. At a massive warehouse in an industrial area of the city, I visited one company taking calls for a U.S. auto parts company. At a cubicle, I met a young woman, hair pulled back in a ponytail, who told me she had worked for the United States Postal Service, paid taxes, and left her two young U.S. citizen children behind when she was deported from Oregon. "They know I'm in a waiting process for a visa. They know I'm just waiting," she told me through tears. "They're patient." Whether it was fear of mass deportations, an economy struggling to recover from the Great Recession, or something else, apprehensions of migrants attempting to cross into the United States illegally dropped to and remain near all-time lows throughout the Obama presidency. It was an administration that grappled, particularly in its first term, with a political strategy of looking tough on the border while attempting to court the growing influence of Latino voters by providing a pathway to citizenship for the millions of undocumented immigrants living in the United States. At the White House, senior-level staff members met regularly with the agencies responsible for carrying out immigration policy: the Department of Homeland Security, the law enforcement operators on the border and the interior; the Department of Health and Human Services, the caregivers of unaccompanied migrant children; and the Department of Justice, the enforcers of the law. Multiple times during Obama's two terms, in 2011, 2014, and 2016, relative quiet at the border was interrupted by what was referred to as a surge in unaccompanied migrant children and families, most fleeing Central America. In response to overcrowded conditions in Border Patrol stations, pictures which were eventually leaked by future Trump advisor Steve Bannon's Breitbart, believe it or not, an outlet not particularly known for humanitarianism, the administration set up temporary soft-sided tent facilities on military bases in Texas, Oklahoma, California, and Florida, where officials from HHS looked after the refugee children until they could be placed with a sponsor, usually family members already in the country. Families were kept together until they were released. I encouraged our people to bring to me all legally available options for dealing with the border, President Obama's second and final Secretary of Homeland Security, Jay Johnson, explained to me after I met him one recent morning. During the 2014 surge, Secretary Johnson and other high-level Homeland Security officials gathered at DHS's Nebraska Avenue complex, the NAC, as they call it, for an immigration all-hands-on-deck meeting. Gil Kerlikowske, the Commissioner of Customs and Border Protection, his deputy Kevin McAleenan, and Tom Homan, the head of Immigration and Customs Enforcement, were there. As a way to avoid these border pileups and stop the flow of young migrants coming to the United States, in Obama's second term, some in the administration had advocated for indefinitely detaining migrant families until their immigration cases were adjudicated. Otherwise stated, the Obama administration proposed ending catch and release, the paroling of undocumented migrants who illegally entered the country while they waited for their court cases. Candidate Trump would later champion this same position from the stage at the Republican National Convention. The Obama administration opened family detention centers in 2014. The ACLU successfully fought them in court, the organization arguing the centers violated a settlement agreement known as Flores, a case named for a young migrant indefinitely and illegally detained in Los Angeles in the 1980s. Obama's migrant families would need to be released from detention within 20 days. Indefinite detention wasn't the only deterrence policy the Obama administration considered. Another, more extreme idea was floated: charging parents who traveled with children with the federal crime of illegally entering the country, necessitating the separation of families, resulting in children going into the care of HHS and adults into the custody of the Department of Justice. "I just couldn't do that," Secretary Johnson told me. But the idea didn't die at the NAC. In the White House Situation Room, Cecilia Munoz, President Obama's director of the Domestic Policy Council, convened one of many regularly scheduled meetings to address the surge in unaccompanied migrant children and families coming to the United States. She considered the meetings a hub, where officials from all relevant agencies, including DHS, HHS, the State Department, and DOJ, would gather to consider policy options to slow the migration flow. When family separations were raised, a spirited discussion ensued, but, quote, "after 5 minutes," she recalled, "the idea died." If it ever made it all the way to President Obama, Munoz said, it would have been in a memo to let him know why the idea was deemed to be a bad one. By late 2016, as the Obama administration was dealing with another migration surge, data shows Border Patrol agents on the ground were carrying out separations anyway. In September, James Jim De La Cruz, senior field specialist at the Department of Health and Human Services Office of Refugee Resettlement, sent a list of procedures for the release of a family after separation by the Department of Homeland Security, including instructions for reunification. De La Cruz made clear in his email that he was not a fan of the policy. "Please consider these items a work in progress with changes to come," he wrote as a disclaimer. "The best that could happen is for the OFO to stop the practice of family separation." OFO, the Office of Field Operations, the folks who wear the blue uniforms at customs at the airport and land ports of entry on our borders with Mexico and Canada, did not stop the alarming practice. 112 were separated by De La Cruz's count between October and December of 2016, as the Obama administration was winding down and Trump was getting ready to move in. I am a citizen of Brazil and am seeking asylum in the United States. When I came to the United States, I passed my initial asylum interview, credible fear interview, and am now in immigration proceedings before an immigration judge to seek asylum. Although I was seeking asylum, I was convicted of the misdemeanor of entering the country illegally. When a border guard approached me a few feet after I entered the country on August 26, 2017, I explained I was seeking asylum. I was still prosecuted. I spent 25 days in jail for the misdemeanor. After my sentence, I was sent on September 22, 2017, to an immigration detention center in Texas, called the El Paso Processing Center, and transferred to the West Texas Detention Facility, also known as Sierra Blanca. I have been in that detention center since that date. I am attempting to proceed with my asylum claim from detention. My biological son, Jay, is 14 and came with me from Brazil. He is also seeking asylum. When I was sent to jail for my conviction, my son was taken from me and sent to a facility in Chicago. I know that the jail did not allow children to stay with their parents, but I have now been out of jail and have been in immigration detention since September 22, 2017. I am desperate to be reunited with my son. I would like to be released with my son so we can live with friends in the United States while we pursue our asylum cases. But if we cannot be released, I would like us to be detained together. I worry about Jay constantly and don't know when I will see him. We've talked on the phone only 5 or 6 times since he was taken away from me. I know that Jay is having a very hard time detained all by himself without me. He is only a 14-year-old boy in a strange country and needs his parent. I hope I can be with my son very soon. I miss him and am scared for him. I declare under the penalty of perjury under the laws of the United States of America that the foregoing is true and correct, based on my personal knowledge. Executed in Sierra Blanca, Texas, on March 7, 2018. Declaration of Miss C, Miss L versus ICE.